Hello, and thank you for joining us on this episode of The Dev Team. I'm Mark Onsman.
I'm Daryl Kilzer.
And I'm Jake Overall.
We're a group of developers and bootcamp instructors here to help you in joining the world as a software developer. Whether you're a self-taught developer, bootcamp grad, or a CS student, we're here to help you fill in some of the knowledge you need to grow in your role as a junior developer.
This week on The Dev Team, Jake gets us started with the word of the day, plugins. I discuss the news with the release of the new GitHub CLI, and Mark deep dives into answering questions online.
All right, so let's go ahead and kick this episode off with talking about plugins. And when I talk about plugins, I don't necessarily mean like you're plugging your phone in.
Or my electric car.
But the concept is there, right? And I think most people are very familiar with the concept of, hey, you plug something in and we're going to extend the functionality of the thing that we just plugged in, right? Like I'm plugging a microphone into a speaker and now I can talk and my voice comes out of the speaker.
Right, you're enhancing the functionality of your computer.
Exactly. Enhancing the functionality of the core system, right? And when we talk about plugins, the concept of being able to write a system that actually supports plugins is actually like it's one of those things that until you've actually sat down to do it, it can be really kind of hard to just even think about, like, how would I support the ability for someone else to maybe create some other additional tool and have it actually work within my system. And so one of the key concepts around the concepts of building a core system that supports plugins is really kind of going to involve things like the strategy pattern, polymorphism, and really, truthfully, what it all boils down to is kind of event-based programming. And so, you know, plugins are kind of one of those things that they can be incredibly difficult to wrap your head around how to start the initial system. But once you actually boil things down, it's the very basic concept is you need to have a core that allows plugins to register themselves and tie into events that the core is being able to raise. And when we talk about and when we train our developers here at CodeWorks, the very first thing we teach about in JavaScript is, you know, the concept of event-based programming. And so really, I don't know if you guys have had any experience with having to either write plugins for a system or having to manage or maintain a core system that supports plugins.
I think that kind of one of the first things that I jump to is actually, can we maybe take the vocab word that's in your vocab word of kind of that event-based programming? And when you say event-based programming, what typically are you looking for in a system and what type of events are you looking to have accessible within that system that maybe somebody could hook into? I think it'd be good to kind of define that box.
Yeah, and it's funny you actually use the word hook. You know, and people who are very familiar with like the React-based system right now, you know, hooks are all the new rage. And it's really just that concept of I'm going to raise some sort of event. And when we talk about events, really, truthfully, we're talking about magic strings, right? We're talking about some sort of magical word that a system can say, this thing happened, new user created, or data inserted, or component mounted. These are magic words that a core system or some sort of piece of software can signify, this thing just occurred. And anyone who cares, now it's time to do the thing that you care about.
So that made clear, obviously, it's the biggest one that we've worked with probably in the most recent history is we've been working with Auth0 and writing plugins for, you know, our students to use so that it simplifies the Auth0 process and they're not having to write up their own entire Auth0 communication system. So we wrote a tool that did that and we'd fire off events like, you know, successful authentications or on auth, like what happens when they authenticate. And I can trigger to say that, hey, the authentication process is completed or auth loading or those types of events.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of those key things, it's like, hey, new user created. So let's go ahead and generate something. Let's write a plugin that listens for new user created. And what it's going to actually do is behind the scenes go take the user's name or email or something of that nature and go generate an avatar for them based upon their name. That could be a completely separate system that has absolutely nothing to do with the auth core, but it ties directly into the auth system, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I actually think of all kinds of things when you said that. And actually, Mark bringing up, let's define this thing. I was like, okay, yeah, that is a pretty broad question. But I immediately thought of like Discord, for example. Writing bots in Discord is a form of a plugin. There's kind of an interface to talk to the services that Discord provides. And then you can key in your functionality for your hooks. New user created. What questions do I want to ask them? What information do I need to get? And that sort of thing. And then I also think back to VS Code and writing extensions in there and kind of manipulating some of those. They're two very different looking pieces of software and modules there, but they're both essentially plugins.
Yeah, there is a distinguishing factor between a true extension and a plugin. But for all intents and purposes, you know, the thing that really needs to be ironclad is the core system. And the core system having particular events, right? And there's also this unspoken rule of, if I'm going to write a good plugin, it should follow all of those solid principles that we talk about, right? It's single responsibility. It should be, open for extension, closed for modification, those types of things, right? Like, I want to make sure that my plugin is not dependent upon, well, there being some other plugin already in the core. And so part of that concept is your core system needs to be able to accept plugins, let them register, have them fire and trigger when they need to trigger, but don't let those plugins actually modify the core system. That's where I think if you've ever had to actually write a core system, it gets really difficult, you know, to think like, I want to be able to support all these different things, when in reality, you should keep the core system very small, very focused on, you know, business rules, security, data manipulation, and then, you know, let the plugins handle the fancy features, right? And let them be isolate and let them do all those individual things.
What's funny, and this is Daryl's territory, so I was thinking maybe he was going to grab this one, but the first thing I actually thought about was like when we've built stuff in Unity, let's build like a game state or something that's...
A manager, yes, very specifically.
So yeah, I mean, that would be another one that I've seen a lot of, is because it becomes that, hey, here's the core functionality of a game, and now let me go bring in, you know, this tool set that I built for, hey, how to handle lightsaber interactions, or how to bring like character controllers and things like that. But Daryl, you might have maybe more experience on that.
Yeah, actually, Jake's last little question, or the last little thing he was saying there, kind of made me instantly think of managers for sure. How would you write the core system so that it supports this? I immediately was like, oh, well, of course, I'm going to need a manager, because all of the features that I want to have, I'm going to truly just write them as I would a plugin to make it extendable. So I'd write that manager, and I would write my own plugins, and then leave this interface open for whoever wants to come along and add on to it. And I think that is probably the game industry is probably one of the biggest ones for that, actually.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely the case. And, you know, one of the things that I think really makes a good core system when it ultimately comes down to it is really truthfully, and, you know, sorry, we're throwing out maybe more than one word of the day type of idea, but it's the concept of a data pipeline. And I'm not sure if you guys have really heard of this concept or not, but the very premise behind a data pipeline is understanding that, you know, the core part of any development system really has to do with data in and data out type of idea, right? And there's a process behind a data pipeline that says, okay, I know and understand when I'm going to be bringing data in. And so let's write a system that's core that basically says, okay, we understand how data gets into our system. We also understand that pretty much every single application deals with, once we've taken in the data, we need to process the data. And then once we've processed the data, at some point in time, other people or other users or even the same user is going to re-consume the data, right? And so your core system, you want to focus on those three things, like the store, process, and consume. And then if plugins need to, you know, change, manipulate, I posted a URL into something like Slack or Discord. So let's have a plugin listen for the message added event. And if it needs to process the message added to load an image or load a GIF or something of that nature, it can do that. But the core system doesn't necessarily have to know that that thing exists.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect example. The little Slack box pops up, you know, and he's probably a plugin type of deal himself. And he immediately starts reading the file and he's like, hey, I noticed this is a Google Doc. Would you like me to directly link your Google Drive or whatever? Say no or yes or whatever. But I think that's a perfect example right there.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, just again, one of those concepts. And this is the whole concept of a plugin really brings together a lot of, you know, the solid principles, the object-oriented principles. You know, it's a lot of things all in one, which is actually pretty cool. But what I think is really important to understand about any really good plugin is it needs to be able to process things from like a transactional standpoint, where almost kind of like a command pattern idea, where I can simply look at what an end result is. And then the plugin should be able to, you know, from a consumer standpoint, do that thing that it needs to do.
So for a junior potentially looking at maybe learning to write plugins or learn on writing plugins, do you have any good advice for maybe a first place to look?
Kind of what we've been talking about, right? Like, I think one of the very best things you can do is Slack, Discord, everyone uses them type of idea. Go look at how the bots work for it. Go look at React Core and look at how the React Hook system, it kind of works, right? If you wanted to, you know, take things maybe a step further, go step into something like Auth0 and look at the authentication hooks and then build some sort of process or some sort of function that based upon an event can do a thing. And I think that's one of the things that's, you know, really pushing the industry forward in a very, very quick manner are things like Lambda functions with AWS or Azure Cloud Functions, the GCP platform. All of these things can basically subscribe to a URL. And when this URL triggers a hook or an event or something of that nature, okay, now we just simply fire off this function to go do a thing. And it doesn't have to be written in the same system. It doesn't even have to ever really truthfully be registered to the core within the code. It can be registered after the fact. And there's a whole nother concept, which really we probably won't have time to jump into, but it's, you know, the database management side of things, right? Like, we can fire off all sorts of actions based upon random events. And I think that's what really makes a good plugin, is knowing what that event is and then firing off an appropriate function that is, again, going to follow all of the appropriate solid principles like we've been talking about. And, you know, making sure that you're not overreaching as a plugin, right? And that's just another one of those concepts of good plugin development, is keep it small. You're better to write maybe 3 or 4 plugins than to try and write one giant plugin that has 40 different features.
All right. Well, thanks for that word of the day. We'll kick it on over to Daryl with the news.
Yeah, from the news today, or this week, rather, I want to talk about the GitHub CLI. It's finally out of beta, and they ended up having something like 250,000 of requests they processed through beta, so it was actually a pretty successful beta. And it's now actually officially out, so you can go and get version 1.0.
Oh, nice, nice.
Nice and clean 0 on the end there. But what's nice about it is this is a true CLI tool that has everything that's on GitHub and everything that you have through Git. If you worked with like VS Code, like we do a lot of stuff with VS Code here, you notice that VS Code's a little bit limited in what it can actually do with Git. They're getting a little better. They made it so you can add repositories and create them and automatically publish them. But if you want to be able to really do that or create new pull requests and handle merges and things like that from the true command line, there's now actually a tool that does all of that for you.
Oh, that seems interesting. And this was kind of hit me by total surprise. I didn't even know GitHub was working on a CLI. I guess this is a question. I'm not sure if you have the answer for it yet or not, Daryl. But one of the confusing things a lot of times is, you know, Git versus GitHub. With GitHub now having its own CLI, does it integrate all of the Git tools as well, or are they still separate?
Let me stack on that before you answer that too. My other question to kind of build into that is, how in this now state would I use Git versus GitHub? What is the same? What is different?
Absolutely. And those are two really good questions. So I do have an answer for them. This is truly the GitHub CLI, definitely not to be confused with Git. So while it does implement a lot of the Git processes and things like that, they are truly two separate things. This is an exposed API through GitHub. And so you are working directly with the things that are possible on GitHub currently. So if you were using some other, you know, Atlassian or some other source control and you were still trying to use Git, this would be a totally different thing. So it's similar to maybe one of those. But it does enable you to pretty much use the entire GitHub workflow. It exposes pretty much everything that the API already had through GitHub itself, but it's now all available on your command line. So you can go and clone a repository down. You can create things on the fly. You can pull issues. You can change to releases and all kinds of stuff like that.
So I could trigger all of my Git hooks and do all the stuff basically from my own command line.
We've moved on from hook.
But what's actually really neat there, though, is that concept of now saying, okay, if I have the GitHub CLI, then I can automate even the things that previously I've had to go into GitHub for just to click a button, right? I can now throw that into my pipeline and have that automated then, yes?
Yeah, you can absolutely make this. What I was looking at that I thought was really, really cool is I can immediately go through and grab just one of my particular projects I'm working on, go look at new pull requests, review them, push that in there, see the differences, read those changes, or switch branches, anything like that. It's actually super cool. I think it's going to be very, very fast because normally you'd go to GitHub and you kind of try to look through everything that you have there, which I don't know about you guys, but I'm not like super fond of UI ever. Like I'm always a command line guy.
Just an elitist.
It's just much faster. It's not so much elitist. It's more of like, I just know exactly what I want to do. And if I can just type it and it knows what I want to do and does it, that's great. I don't have to figure out these arbitrary icons and buttons.
If you have to take your hands off of the keyboard and go grab that terrible like mouse,
oh,
right?
Boy.
Like... it's going to slow you down. But so I guess one thing that I've recently started using GitHub for a lot, though, is like code review. And you know, the diff tools are pretty nice on the GitHub platform. Do you know, are they bringing that to, you know, a command line prompt style system? Are we integrating with Vim? Like, how is that working?
I'm going to try and visualize how that's going to work. Yeah.
Yeah. So it is kind of color coded. And it does like have little printouts and little tables and things like that. Shows you the number of lines have been affected and whether they're added and removed. So it is pretty thorough and efficient in that way. You can make aliases to run a bunch of commands as well and things of that nature. So once you figure out exactly what you want to do, yeah, sure, you can kind of customize it to do exactly what you want there.
Right. Throw it all together in like a bash script or something of that nature.
Make a script for like the fire script. Like, oh, just copy everything into a new branch. The building's on fire. Now I can run it in one command instead of a couple.
Yeah. And I think that what I was reading is they were adding like a support in there for you can create a gist essentially and throw a bunch of stuff in there and actually be able to share that and utilize that across different users and things of that nature for it. So it's actually pretty cool. You can do your little pull request checks as well. And so it does actually have the little check mark in there and like the commit numbers and all that. So
I think that's nice. The other part I see maybe a lot of big benefit, though, is even just like initial project architecture. How many times it's like, okay, I need to start to get new GitHub repo. And okay, now I have to have my main branch, which I'm now going to change to production. And then I have to make a dev branch from that. And I'm going to set the dev branch as a default. And I want to set up all these rules. And if it's like, hey, I'm doing these same steps every single time, just being able to even simply from the command line hook into that and do all that for you is awesome.
Yeah, that will greatly speed up that process, you know. So I, of course, am not going to complain about having another tool in the tool belt, especially if it's one that's going to speed up, you know, especially from our perspective where we do create a lot of new projects, you know, from a education standpoint, walking students through that process, you know. Anytime you have to tell someone to go click on a button on a web page, there's always prone to error. So, you know, if we could automate that, perfect. Let's do it.
Yeah, I think it's going to be super cool. The best thing, though, that I did see, my favorite thing, probably Mark, you'll enjoy this. Mark's always asking me how to prune the branches, the local ones.
On your local branches, yeah.
Yeah, when you're using VS Code, if you go and change and merge a branch, of course, it still hangs out on your VS Code. And you can inadvertently create it again and make it bring it back to life again. This will automatically ask you, hey, you just merged that thing. You want to get rid of this? And so that's kind of a built-in feature.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. Just like it actually does on the website, right?
Yeah.
Like, hey, delete this branch. You know, let's follow those good practices. And that is nice, you know. And if GitHub, you know, we can pretty much trust that what they're pushing is, you know, industry standard. So that's a really good thing. That is neat.
You set up your little command line. You go, hey, go merge this thing. All right, merge successfully. All the checks ran. Now delete it. Done and done.
Yeah. And I guess I keep looking towards, the automation process of that. Like I do my code review or whatever, and then I just go into my command line and say, confirm. And it maybe runs the four or five processes that occur when I actually merge it in and close that branch and prune it and all that kind of stuff. I can now potentially even write a custom command to do.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, that'll be great. I don't have to copy and paste, from my package.json, a 46-line NPM, executable or whatever. That's going to be nice, I think.
All right. Well, thanks, Daryl. Well, I'm going to jump in then and kind of talk about our deep dive for the week. So basically, what I really wanted to look at this week, I probably don't do this as much as I should, and I think we all kind of have it, and it ebbs and flows. But essentially, the concept I want to talk about is helping other people online. So just kind of to talk about the good, the bad, and we're going to start about the bad, and I see everyone smiling because they kind of know what's coming up. You go to Stack Overflow, somebody's asked, how do I do XYZ?
Well, why the heck are you doing that that way? That's stupid.
Right. You should be doing ABC instead. Or maybe the alternative, it's from 2015 and, they had this error and it's the exact error you have and no one ever replied. And then they just edited it and said, never mind, I got it. And you're like, oh my God, what was it? And you don't actually find that solution.
Of course, somewhere in there is that, well, I have a client, you see. These are my constraints. Oh, you have a client. Okay, gotcha.
Right. Now I understand. So I think that what's funny about that, and the first thing that I have to say on this topic is thank goodness that there are more generous people out there than maybe myself. The amount of good help that you can find online, either in Stack Overflow or, through a random Gitter or Discord or Slack or all these different channels that you can join. There are amazing people out there who just, I don't know how they have enough time in the day to answer and field so many questions, but they do. And, just that is a huge, thank you from me. A lot of what I've learned in development truthfully comes from copy and pasting Stack Overflow and throwing it into a project and it works and I have no idea why. That's a really great thing. But I think being a good online contributor, it's hard. It's really hard. And especially you take a platform like Stack Overflow, you can't even answer a question until you have a little bit of rep points or points, whatever, on Stack Overflow. I can't remember what they call them, but you have to build some sort of credibility before you can even post an answer. And you can't post, or I think the way that you kind of do that is by getting a single comment upvoted. And so I think Stack Overflow has a pretty good system for kind of helping to identify, these are good ways that you can help online. But yeah, it's a difficult task.
Yeah. So you guys know me. I like my lists. So, of course, these are my do's and don'ts. So we'll kind of go through these real quick and just kind of get your specific feedback. But the first one is one we've already kind of touched on a little bit. But basically, don't tell them whatever they're using is just a bad choice. Like, hey, how do I do this in Vue? Oh, you shouldn't use your Vue. You should use React. Or, hey, I was trying to do this in F sharp. Well, why are you doing that? You should use C sharp. So my first advice is don't tell them just their question is bad. And leave it at that. That's not helpful.
Right. And I mean, that's definitely a case. And like Daryl said, a lot of the times if someone's asking a very pointed question, there's usually some sort of constraint involved. And that's the reason why they're asking it that way. Now, I think that's not true in every situation, right? There are some people that simply post what is very obviously a college, textbook question, or it's their final or something of that nature, and they're like, how do I do X, right? And it's like, well, that is pretty much the final that everyone gets in college, so I'm not going to answer that one, right? But I think for the most part, telling someone that the way they're trying to accomplish something is stupid, but not provide any type of additional follow-up, then yeah, you're just being a troll, and that's not helpful to anyone.
Yeah, you got to kind of reframe it, and this is something that we're probably exceptional at with being teachers and all. You don't want to offend them or demean them in any way, because you've immediately closed off that ability to communicate correctly with them. They're no longer really listening to what you have to say, and it's not going to matter whatever you typed out anyway. The best thing you can do is for sure just kind of establishing that context if you need more information there to correctly answer the question. Or you can say, here is what I would possibly look at doing, and if you're interested in something that maybe that I found more efficient, here's this. And you can make that as a suggestion, whether or not they, keep that at the bottom line and keep it kind of brief. And if they want to inquire more on it, they will. And if they don't, well, you've helped them the best that you can.
The other kind of piece I wanted to add, so the next one, and that this is kind of a do in that. And so for me, and this kind of summarizes what Jake said and what you said there, the most important thing is to answer the question first. You can provide your opinion. You can provide that context. You can say, hey, this is maybe not the best approach, but I would always start with that with the answer. Hey, here's what you're looking for. Either here's a link to another article that kind of gives more context around your question, but here's why maybe that's not the best approach. And if you have the opportunity, do it this way instead. So for me, that's where that do comes in to answer their question. If, you know, in a way that you can, and then provide that context.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the something to kind of think about, right? And I think in personas, right? A lot of the times, like, I have the persona of, you know, Jake, the instructor here at CodeWorks. And I have the persona of, like, Jake, the developer who doesn't know what he's doing, right? And, you know, so it's kind of one of those things where, you know, if I'm going to go online and I'm going to try and answer a question, am I answering the question as an educator, as a, I am trying to educate this random person that I have absolutely zero context around who they even are, or am I going in there as, hey, this is a dev question that, hey, that looks like something fun to just potentially solve. Like, I'm going to take this almost as like a whiteboard challenge and see if I can do it type of idea, right? And I think that's there's a difference there in the style of how you answer a question, right? And so one of the things that I commonly do actually on Stack Overflow is I'll search in the new column under some tags that, you know, I'm actually fairly good at. And, you know, if it's, you know, JavaScript questions or browser related questions or things of that nature, like I can jump in there and I can take on the role of the educator because that's what I do. I do know that. But if I'm going to dive into something that I'm not as well, you know, versed in, you know, let's take a Docker question or something of that nature, I'm going in as like, oh, that is a good question. I don't have an answer. So let me see if I can solve it. And if I can, then I'll post, hey, this is the solution that worked for me. I don't know if it meets all your constraints or not.
So the next thing I would say is avoid providing the same answer over and over and over. If it's answered and you're not adding to it, just let it go. And I feel like this I see all the time, and it's almost like those people, you'll hear karma hunters or whatever, right? They're just kind of hunting for like, oh, give me upvotes too. If the question is answered and the context you're providing doesn't change or extend, or maybe if it was an old question and, you know, oh, well, that no longer works, right? Those are fine. But if you're just posting the same thing over and over and again, just don't.
Yeah, I think, you know, both Stack Overflow and GitHub, you know, under the issues tab, they have ways to, you know, link as duplicate question and drop a link to where the actual question like originated from. Like that is a much better approach. So yeah, I would agree with that 100%. You know, I think that sometimes that might be a little overused and it might come across as aggressive or like
degrading
or, you know, off-putting.
Obviously you didn't look enough to find this question was already asked.
Right. And so I think that there's ways to actually post like, hey, this is a potential duplication of this question. Like check here, see if it solves it. If it does, let's leave it at that. We'll close the forum or we'll close the group or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, yeah, in that case, I usually look, so I probably don't use Stack Overflow that much either because I was like, what is that? Some kind of cred system? You know, got to build up credibility to answer it. But I do like going on like indie game dev forums and stuff like that, people that maybe don't have as much experience. When I go to answer those questions, if there's already kind of an answer, but I have maybe a slight extension to it or a slight modification or suggestion there, I just usually throw it in a comment on the answer that I think is the most correct. And I'll let them get the credit for it. I mean, they came there first, and just add my 2 cents kind of in there. Or if it's a duplicate, like what Jake was saying, I think you're absolutely correct. There's a very good way to say, hey, this is another place. This was kind of a very similar question was asked, and it may have some more context around what you're trying to do and maybe some more advice there.
I'm not sure if this is on your list or not yet, and you know, maybe it's a different thing, but you know, there's also a good way to ask a question, and it's, you know, having the appropriate context around everything. Like I've seen questions that, you know, people absolutely just, they destroy you on LinkedIn or not LinkedIn, but Stack Overflow. If you post it and you don't have like any context, it's like, why does this one line of code not work?
Cannot read property length of undefined.
Right. It's like, well, obviously, like that is an unanswerable question because we have no additional context. So when possible, big code snippets or full methods or at least full classes, right? And, you know, if you have logs or something of that nature, adding those to the question is also really helpful. Better ways to maybe actually get your question answered is providing appropriate context.
I think that builds on two things that I was going to say. One is essentially don't degrade people for asking. And that kind of comes in that context. If you find that question where it's like, hey, this is super vague, explain why it's vague, right? And say, oh, you know, maybe the question is, hey, I hit this endpoint and I got 404 not found. What's the problem, right? Well, I can now explain the context of what 404 is, but I don't actually have the ability to solve your problem unless you give me some more information about it. So I think that's where I was kind of, don't degrade them and say, well, you're dumb. This is, I can't answer this. There's a good way to do that. And I guess, you know, all around this basically is a whole conversation on what is online etiquette. The same rules apply.
Yeah. And I think, you know, a few episodes back or whatever, we were talking about how to contribute to an open source project, right? And like asking for help online follows all of those exact same like etiquette rules. And quite frankly, if you want to take on the form of answering questions, like you have to, of course, follow all those same types of principles as well, because like Daryl said, if you're instantly just off-putting or, you know, dismissal or something of that nature, like even if you are a whiz and you do have the right answer, if your first approach to me was really aggressive, then I don't care anyways. Like I'm not going to use that.
Yeah, especially if I don't even understand your answer all the way, because you probably used a bunch of big keywords to try to sound smarter than you are. Immediately, I'm going to be like, well, I'm definitely not going to ask that guy to clarify on that, right? That's what I immediately can think of a few times that's happened. Maybe a little judgmental there still.
The other thing I was going to say, and this kind of built on Jake's question before, but when you're answering those questions, you know, try and describe why the provided solution is the right one, because I probably approach these more in that teacher mentality, but not always am I teaching the person who asked the question, right? How many times have you run into a problem, you find that exact same problem on Stack Overflow, you find the answer in there, but you never asked that question. You just found somebody else's question. So I think that that's the context that I look at that as too, is when I answer this, if this is the correct answer for that person, it resolves the problem, it's going to be marked complete. This is potentially the answer other people are going to read when they find that question. And in answering the initial question, perhaps I can provide better context for those people when they find this answer.
Or bare minimum, like go back and if that Stack Overflow question is the one that helped you, upvote it, please. Like, again, like Stack Overflow does depend on like a credit-based system. And so if you do find an answer, take the few seconds to go ahead and upvote right now. I also believe that you can't even upvote something as the right answer without at least a little bit of credit, which I think you get just enough to like do that when you first create your account. But if you ever get downvoted on anything, you lose that credit to even upvote or something of that nature, right? Like, so it's a funny system, of course. But, you know, I do think that taking at least the bare minimum time necessary to go click an upvote button, like, it really does help a lot. It helps for future searchability and things of that nature.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I've done. I don't think I've actually ever posted a question on there. I usually search and there's usually been something that has enough that I can glean something out of it. And it's almost always exactly kind of what Mark described. I'm reading through comments even and looking for someone that has a fairly verbose answer there, because they probably just filled in all the context that I'm missing from the initial question that helps me tie in exactly how this works with what I'm trying to do specifically. So.
Yeah, there's a funny story. I believe it's Scott Hanselman, and I don't know if, you know, maybe not everyone knows who he is, but he's a big time like C#, you know, he's a language maintainer, things of that nature. Very, very smart, very, very intelligent guy, right? And he was at a conference, and I believe this was Scott, but he's at a conference and he talks about how, you know, he uses Stack Overflow and, you know, he also answers hundreds of questions, but you know, he came across a question, you know, or came across a problem, he didn't know how to solve it. And so he goes to Google and of course does the standard developer thing, like, how do I solve this thing, right? And he goes and opens up a Stack Overflow and sees the answer, because, you know, you scroll right past the question, you go straight to the answer, copy paste, and it worked, you know. And he's like, hey, cool, that worked. And he went back to actually like upvote the answer, and then Stack Overflow told him, hey, you're not allowed to upvote your own answer. And so it's kind of funny, because it's like, you know, even these developers who, you know, we look at and it's like, oh man, like those guys are so incredible, like they still continue to use the exact same resources that we use, right? Like it's one of those things where no one remembers how to do everything. And I could have a complete and total like brain fart and not remember how to do this thing for the life of me that I've done 100,000 times. And yeah, I'm going to have to go back and re-reference it somewhere, right? And that's where I think, you know, one of the really great things about Stack Overflow is there are so many questions that have been posted, and that's that's true of pretty much any stack exchange type idea, that you can generally find, you know, a good question coupled with a really good answer. And again, just from me to everyone out there who takes the time to do that, you know, thank you so much for both being brave enough to post questions and, again, brave enough or taking enough time out of your day to actually answer a question.
All right. And I think that we'll go ahead and close it on that note. So we'll go ahead and wrap up this episode there. And I want to thank everyone for continuing to listen to our podcast. Again, if you are enjoying this series so far, please make sure to like and subscribe on whatever your favorite podcast network is you're listening to us on. And until then, have a good week.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Dev Team. If you're interested in learning more about our team or possibly starting a career in software development, reach out to us at boisecodeworks.com. Follow us on Facebook and like and subscribe to this podcast to continue to receive the latest updates. Until then, from The Dev Team, remember, if you want clean code, wash your hands.